This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Heat stroke hits out of nowhere fast. Heart beats wildly, it won't last. Dehydration makes you weak. Muscles cramp, it's hard to speak. Ah, yeah.
How your body breaks down in extreme heat. We start with the paper, 27 Ways a Heat Wave Can Kill You, Deadly Heat in the Era of Climate Change. Medical Terms Explained. Short clips from an EcoShock interview with the lead author, Dr. Camila Mora, are included. Australian heat and health expert Elizabeth Hanna makes it all clear in a quick replay. Then we have a fast review of 15 lessons from the Russian heat wave of 2010. 55,000 people killed, wheat exports annihilated, and much more. A new compilation of heat survival know-how for you. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Stay cool, stay cool. Heat it kills. Don't you be a fool. Ah!
Looking at world temperature maps has become a gruesome duty. In the first week of July 2024, glaring red bubbles of heat far above normal rested over Spain, the Mediterranean, and off into eastern Russia. Sandwiched in between, colder than expected temperatures over northern Europe, then, extending into the UK and Ireland. About a week ago, an Irish listener complains they had not seen any heat, much less summer. Europe was like two separate universes running on different temperatures. It is all in the bend of the upper atmospheric winds, the jet stream, my friends. Lower down on this EU Copernicus satellite map, they ran out of red colors to cover the abnormally hot weeks and months in North Africa. Experts devised a new color code going into purples and then white, I think. White hot? Algeria is a hot country, I've been there. But Algeria has smashed, not broken, but smashed heat records over and over again in 2024. Remember, Sudanese refugee camps with 5 million people under canvas at best are broiling beyond human capacity. People in Egypt and Gaza are roasting in the heat. Turkey is unbearably hot. Iran is simply under heat siege. It won't go away, even during the elections there. Dozens died of the heat in India last week, again, as in the week before. And in some parts of Japan, the government is warning citizens, do not go outside for any reason. The heat is too dangerous. Officially, more than 7 people died in Tokyo due to the heat. In an overheated city of 13 million people, the real toll will be higher than that. North America experienced a rare double heat dome. It has happened before, but never with such new high temperatures. The hottest days ever were just recorded in Palm Springs and Las Vegas, Nevada. It was 120 degrees Fahrenheit in Las Vegas, or 48.8 C. That is not just a fraction higher, but a full 3 degrees Fahrenheit over the previous record. In the east, at the very same time, Raleigh, North Carolina set its highest ever temperature. On July 6, 2024, Raleigh reached an all-time record high of 106 degrees Fahrenheit. 41.1 C, with a maximum of feels-like heat index of 118 degrees Fahrenheit, 47.7 C. Washington, D.C. felt like over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. It is 101 degrees Fahrenheit, 38.3 C, outside my studio here in Canada, and it's still climbing. Any wind genuinely feels like a hairdryer in the face. It is way too hot.
Way too hot!
On Radio EcoShock, I asked top doctors from the best institutions to describe how heat kills. But heat doesn't just kill. In just a day of extreme heat or a few days, humans can suffer organ damage with lasting impacts. They may lose abilities and then die earlier than they would have without that heat damage. All this has been tested by doctors and shown in major studies in multiple countries. You know there is long COVID. It now appears there is also long heat stress damage. This means official statistics for heat deaths in countries that publish those figures are not just underestimated, they are unknown. In 2017, Dr. Camilo Mora from the University of Hawaii talked to us about his paper called 27 Ways a Heat Wave Can Kill You, Deadly Heat in the Era of Climate Change. He begins by describing the five major ways excess heat damages your body. Most of them relate to your blood circulation, and that makes sense. Blood becomes heated with an energy exchange in our cells. That heat is released through the skin, and that process is helped by evaporation. You know all that, sweat if needed. So it makes sense that heat higher than your body temperature will make the natural cooling system process more difficult. The processes of heat damage involve some medical terms, but they are not difficult to understand, and it's your body. If you grasp these basics, you may be able to help yourself or someone else survive extreme heat. The Mora-led team of scientists searched through masses of medical and other scientific literature to find reports of physical damage by heat. They found five physiological mechanisms triggered by heat exposure. These five mechanisms can affect seven different vital organs. Excess heat can damage the brain, heart, intestines, kidney, liver, lungs, and pancreas. If you multiply five mechanisms by seven organs, there might be 35 different ways heat could kill you, but the authors found some were either duplicated or not documented, settling on 27 different provable ways you can be killed by heat. We start with something called ischemia. What is that? I-S-C-H-E-M-I-A, ischemia. In this show, we will not discuss organ damage, covering instead the five ways organs get damaged, the mechanisms of heat in our body. And we begin, as this paper does, with ischemia. Now, according to Wikipedia, ischemia is a restriction in the blood supply to any tissue, muscle group, or organ of the body, causing a shortage of oxygen that is needed for cellular metabolism to keep tissue alive. In the show, I play about 2 minutes where Dr. Mora talks about ischemia and also the gut. Well, let's dig into the very good science in your paper about how our bodies really work when they get overheated, and I'd like to go step by step, Camilo. And the first process we all experience is that blood flows towards the skin trying to cool us off. But what really happens there that is a risk?
So the risk that comes from when you get overheated, just like when you go for a run and you start overheating, your body start generating heat and you need to expel the heat. So the body, what it does there is start making the heart pump harder, and it closes blood flow to many organs in a way so that all of the blood now goes to your skin, where it gets cooled down through the process of evaporation of your sweat. So the blood cools down and then it comes back in into your body cooler. Now, the problem when it's hot outside is that the sweat doesn't evaporate, then the blood comes back in hot. So the body makes an extra effort then to send even more blood to your skin as a way for it to cool down. By doing so, what happens is that it deprives many organs of blood. And that's what is called ischemia. Basically, several organs start being deprived of blood, and what it does is that it creates these anoxic conditions on those organs, right? And when you have a lack of oxygen on those organs, then that creates all kind of chemical reactions there that are detrimental to that organ. The organ that is the most critical, interestingly enough, I found, was the gut. Obviously, you are hot, you just want to cool down the body. The first organ that it cuts the blood supply to are the gut, because you don't need the gut when it's pretty hot. But unfortunately, if the conditions are very long, the gut, the lining of your intestines breaks, and now all of the things that you had inside your guts leak in into your bloodstream. And what you ended up having is this massive contamination of your body with everything that was in your guts into your bloodstream. And again, all of that, the result of the fact that there was just no blood getting into your guts. And that's one of the mechanisms that we found causes people to die during these heat waves. Basically, your guts just break, and that obviously is a cause for death.
Dr. Camilo Mora from the University of Hawaii was recorded on Radio EcoShock in 2017. And you can note that ischemia can restrict oxygen to any organ, including the brain. This may explain why part of the process of heat illness can be losing cognitive ability. The person with heat damage may not realize how serious their condition is. They could make foolish and unsafe choices during this stage, like extending a hike on a hot day. I can do it. Or diving in a river without knowing how to swim. And believe it or not, both of those are common during heat waves and have happened recently in the news. The 27 Ways to Die of Heat paper says, quote, when the human body is exposed to heat, the hypothalamus triggers a cardiovascular response that dilates blood vessels to redirect blood from the core to the periphery of the body, where heat is dissipated to the environment. This compensatory shunting of blood to the skin results in inadequate blood flow to other organs, that is, ischemia, one of the 5 identified mechanisms, end quote. The authors later continue, cell damage from heat cytotoxicity, which we'll cover in a minute, and ischemia can lead to other serious conditions, such as acute tubular necrosis in the kidneys, permanent loss of brain function, liver endotoxins in the blood, inflammation of the pancreas, and not enough oxygen getting to the lungs into the blood because of injury of the pulmonary endothelium. I note that loss of brain function and permanent. The second way heat damages our body is called heat cytotoxicity. Our cells depend on a fairly narrow range of temperatures within the body to continue living and to function. If body temperatures go beyond the tolerance of the cells, well, cell death begins. That is cytotoxicity. I'm about to play you a short clip with Dr. Mora on heat cytotoxicity. And what is heat cytotoxicity? Did you already cover that?
No. So another thing that happens, obviously the ischemia is one that can kill you. The other one that can kill you as well is what is called heat cytotoxicity. So when the blood comes back in hot, and obviously your body is generating more heat, the temperature of the body gets higher than the optimum temperature, which is roughly 37 degrees Celsius. So if it gets hotter than that, then basically you start cooking yourself. Think about like a sunburn. So many organs start getting damaged, physically damaged, but some other organs can also break. Yeah, but just imagine this like a massive sunburn, and eventually your skin just peels off. So the same thing happens, but now inside your body, and what it does, of course, is that it starts helping the breaking of the membranes that maintain the structure of many of these organs. So the heart, for instance, start breaking into pieces, and then it doesn't work as good in a moment when you need your heart very bad. So having a sex heat is pretty bad for your heart. It's also terrible for your lungs. Obviously, you start respirating more because you need more oxygen. And with this heat cytotoxicity and you cooking your lungs, the lungs don't work as well. So many people start also suffering from lack of oxygen getting to to their bloodstream. And that is what is called heat cytotoxicity, basically the time when the temperature is hotter than what the temperature that can be tolerated by yourself.
Let's talk about inflammation and blood clots. As I understand it, the third mechanism, the inflammatory response, involves an overactive or improperly targeted immune system, a condition that develops during longer durations of excessive heat. In persistent hyperthermia, immune mediators like cytotoxins can lead to leakage from the affected organs and damaging chemical states. Not easy to understand, but once the cells get overheated, various organs, including the gut, can leak. Inflammation of the vascular system can also trigger another mechanism called disseminated intravascular coagulation. As you might imagine, this involved blood clotting, and that is the double danger. You know blood clots can wreck a limb or collect in your lungs or brain, causing major function loss or even kill you? As Wiki tells us, disseminated intravascular coagulation, quote, symptoms may include chest pain, shortness of breath, leg pain, problems speaking, or problems moving parts of the body, end quote. And then there's blood clots. Really, blood clots are a factor in heating?
That you had these blood clogging proteins that, interestingly enough, are sensitive to heat, so they become overreactive. So everywhere they are, they just create coagulation wherever they are. So that the clogging can kill you, right, because you ended up getting a clog. But the other problem that will happen is the fact that you will start running out of the clogging protein, so that if you had a smart cut, You can bleed to death because the body cannot clog it, because you pretty much use all of your resources of those proteins. So those cloggings are actually bad from both ends. They can kill you because they clog the blood, and when you run out of them, the lack of proteins that clog can also kill you, because you can have a danger of dying from an hemorrhage just because there is no clogging proteins left.
During heat, blood can begin to coagulate, clogging arteries or veins. That, of course, can be deadly or lead to serious damage to a limb or something else. But as the body continues to create more clogging agents, it can eventually use them all up. It runs out. Then the body cannot stop any bleeding that may happen after that. So blood clotting during heat exposure is a double-edged danger.
Skin gets red and you start to sweat. 27 ways to feel regret. Cracks on the road, burning feet. The air so warm you can barely breathe. Feeling dizzy, can't stand straight. Heat can't seal a dangerous fate. Stay cool, stay cool. Heat it kills, don't you be a fool. Ah!
We round up our tour of ways excess heat can kill with the fifth mechanism from that 2017 summary. It's called rhabdomyolysis. I had never heard of it. Rhabdomyolysis. Sometimes the name is shortened to rhabdo, and that seems a little bit easier. Wiki says, quote, rhabdomyolysis, shortened as rhabdo, is a condition in which damaged skeletal muscle breaks down rapidly, often due to high-intensity exercise over a short period of time. Symptoms may include muscle pains, weakness, vomiting, and confusion. There may be tea-colored urine or an irregular heartbeat. Some of the muscle breakdown products, such as the protein myoglobulin, are harmful to the kidneys and can cause acute kidney injury. The muscle damage is most usually caused by a crush injury, strenuous exercise, medications, or a substance use disorder. Other causes include infections, electrical injury, heat stroke, prolonged immobilization, lack of blood flow to a limb, or snake bites, as well as intense prolonged exercise in hot conditions, end quote from Wikipedia. Well, earlier I talked about the immune system and I asked Dr. Mora whether excess heat can damage that. He said they found no literature to support damage to the immune system by heat. However, 7 years later, a new study by the American Heart Association reveals heat can damage the immune system. Published March 20, 2024, the paper is called Heat Exposure May Increase Inflammation and Impair the Immune System. They say, quote, short-term exposure to higher heat may increase inflammation and interfere with normal immune system functions in the body, which may in turn increase susceptibility to infections and accelerate the progression of cardiovascular disease, according to preliminary research, end quote. When the heat waves strike in 2024, there is a double risk. The immune system may already be damaged by COVID, especially with repeated infections, or excess heat exposure may lower the immune system, making us more likely to get COVID if exposed. Threats interact. With Dr. Mora, we kept our focus on the medical ways heat damages people's bodies. But everyone knows extreme heat, especially long-lasting heat waves, have significant psychological impacts as well. In 2023, the U.S. National Center for Biotechnology Information, the NCBI, published a reference paper called High Temperatures on Mental Health, Recognizing the Association and Need for Proactive Strategies. They say, quote, psychological symptoms can include stress, irritability, sleep disturbances, reduced motivation, decreased mood and enjoyment, and agitation. And check this out from the NCBI paper, quote, the psychological stress response to high temperatures includes the release of stress hormones like adrenaline and cortisol. These hormones can evoke emotional responses, leading to feelings of irritability, restlessness, and heightened emotional sensitivity. Individuals may find themselves more prone to frustration, impatience, and interpersonal conflicts during heat exposure, underscoring the intricate link between physiological and emotional well-being, end quote. And then there is this, aggravation of pre-existing mental health conditions. High temperatures can exacerbate symptoms of pre-existing mental health conditions. Individuals with conditions such as anxiety disorders, depression, or bipolar disorder may experience intensified symptoms during heat waves, making it crucial to manage their mental health effectively. Be aware, heat affects the brain and can lead to very poor decision-making. As I said, a hot person who cannot swim may dive into a lake anyway, and we will hear about that in my coverage of the Russian heat wave in 2010. There were a lot of drownings then. Alcohol may have been a contributing factor, and people use alcohol to try and cool down or to end the suffering of the heat. But it is not uncommon to find a person experiencing heat stroke who is unaware of the danger they are in. They may continue to exercise or work in very dangerous conditions. The coach may encourage them. They may dispute that they are in danger, even while displaying obvious signs of heat illness. They may decline treatment. Those trying to help heat victims should keep cognitive decline in mind. I wonder, as heat waves become dominant, perhaps billions of people will face decline in some mental functioning. They may carry long-lasting to lifelong physical damages, including undiagnosed organ damage. If someone dies of heart failure due to damage suffered during a heat wave years earlier, neither doctors nor the family would know the real cause was heat. Excess deaths may increase during global warming, and that's the only way we'll see it. To my knowledge, the scope and facts of this heat risk to future populations is not known and possibly not knowable. Scientists may try models for predictions, but you can't predict much when multiple systems collide and states of chaos multiply. Stranger still, as Dr. Mora tells us, we may not even know we are dying of heat. The death may come days or years later. This delay is called the harvesting effect. There may be more fatalities 1 or 2 days after the heat wave is gone, and countless more over following years or decades. Let's go to a replay of one of my best interviews on the medical impacts of extreme heat. Our guest was Elizabeth Hanna. She is a nurse with a doctorate and was national convener of the Climate Change Adaptation Research Network for Human Health at Australian National University. We talked in 2013, and her wisdom and experience in this field is just what we need to hear again today as the planet roasts.
Radio EcoShock.
Some scientists and authorities, like the International Energy Agency, warn humanity is headed for a world 3.5 degrees C hotter in as little, perhaps, as 25 years. Perhaps you think we'll just turn up the air conditioner, but much of the world's work is done outside. Can humans cope with those kind of temperatures? Here to help us is Dr. Elizabeth Hanna. She's a nurse with a doctorate and national convener of the Climate Change Adaptation Research Network for Human Health at Australian National University. We've reached Dr. Hanna in Warsaw at the COP19 Climate Talks. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
And hello to your listeners.
Liz, let's get to your specialty, the capacity of the human body to cope with climate change. What are the challenges that we will face?
If we continue up to, you know, that 3.5 and some say 4 and indeed 6 degrees, the essential thing is this is ultimately, it's not compatible with human existence. That's the raw and the ugly truth of it. And that's why we really do need to do something about it. And of course, the pathway to that is it's not all going to be hunky-dory and really nice until one day it's not pleasant. It'll be this gradual increasing change, such as we're already noticing. And if you notice the, you know, the heat waves that are happening all over the world, the floods, the droughts, the, you know, the typhoons such as Haiyan, this is happening when it's not even 1 degree warmer. I shudder to think what 2 degrees, you know, the guardrail that we're all trying to stay below, even that is going to cause so much more human misery. So, I mean, the major health impacts, it depends really on where you are. The countries that are vulnerable to these typhoons, they're obviously going to have more of those, such as the Philippines. It's very difficult for the climate scientists to attribute any specific particular event to, this one was climate change. But that's in many respects the wrong question. The trend is, on the basis of probability, the fact that we're getting so many more and they're so more intense, that's the real question. And the answer to that is a definite yes. And so the people that are suffering the typhoons, Australia's had, you know, intense droughts, intense heat waves and intense floods, and we're not alone. You know, Europe lost, you know, some reports, including the World Health Organization, suggest that 70,000 people died in the heat waves in Europe. And that's temperatures that are nothing like what Australia hits. But the whole thing is relative. Russia, you know, the Moscow heat wave, A, caused lots of fires, B, caused a lot of crop failures. And one of the sort of less direct impacts are when you have major heat waves and droughts and indeed floods. If you wipe out the crops from one of the major food exporting countries, such as what Russia did at that time, and you can sort of understand, if they lose a good deal of their stable crops, they stopped exporting. When a major food exporter stops exporting, the food prices globally escalate, and that carries over to the other basic foodstuffs. And if you think about the people who are largely dependent, you know, particularly the sub-Saharan African people, if they're already spending 80% of their weekly income on food, their capacity to absorb doubling or an extra 50% of the food prices is not something that they can't really do. So there are the complex ramifications in terms of food shortages and food insecurity. Water problems, obviously people are going to suffer if they're caught in the floods. The risk of cholera and the waterborne diseases. General heat causes a lot of extra foodborne diseases. And of course, when you change the climate and you get, you know, the malaria, which once upon a time was restricted to a certain area because it doesn't like getting below 15 degrees, when you find with warming in many countries, the range of the mosquito is extending into what we call virgin populations. And so the people who are not equipped to cope physiologically and indeed in their cultural practices, and indeed the medicos who, you know, they're not used to looking for, you know, malaria, dengue is another one that's extending. And of course, my own work is heat. That's a real killer for places like Australia. But of course, as we've seen, I mean, cooler places like Russia and Europe have had massive death rates because of heat.
Well, let's talk about the human body. What are the upper tolerances that we can handle?
It's interesting. When you think about it, we need to keep our core temperature within a really very narrow range between about 36 and 37. And when the outside air temperature is higher than that, then it's very difficult for us to lose heat. And we generate heat just through our metabolism. But it's interesting that sort of 80% of the energy produced by working muscles is heat. So that has to be dissipated. And when you have temperatures outside the human body, the ambient temperature, that's getting close to that, then it's really difficult to shed that extra heat. And so if we can't shed it, we store it. And as you know, when your temperature gets to about 38, you start feeling pretty ordinary. 38.5, you're certainly reaching for the Panadol. And in hospitals where I've started my working career, we'd be in intensive care. We'd be certainly giving not only aspirins but antibiotics. You're really quite ill when your core temperature is about 39. And, of course, people die when their core temperature reaches 40, 41. We really can't tolerate that now. And what's really significant is that it depends on what your normal range is, your normal natural environment, but there is an upper limit. And if you think about when people like to put the air conditioning on or the heating, they tend to set it at around about 22 degrees, which is 15 degrees cooler than our body temperature. And of course, this basically means that when the outside temperature is much hotter than our body temperature, then this is when it becomes problematic.
Liz Hanna, in the business press, major corporations and economists worry a lot about worker productivity. They tell us productive workforce, that's the key, yet they don't seem to worry about global warming at the same time. Are they missing something?
Absolutely. And this is a focus of a good deal of the work that I'm doing at the moment. That's actually looking to see what is the human thermal tolerance. I mean, obviously I'm Australian and my work is focused on Australia at the moment, but it's part of a global project. But at the moment, what we find is that the places in the southern part of the continent, they actually think are hot days around about, you know, 25, 27 degrees. They can keep working, but they, you know, they feel it hot. At the top end of Australia, where it's in the tropical region, we've got Darwin that's sort of 32, 33 degrees. It used to be 32, 33 every day. Well, now it's sort of 35 every day. But the humidity is extreme. And every time when we go and visit those places, the plane opens and we just get knocked by this wall of sort of oppressive heat and humidity, and we find it very difficult to move. A lot of people move up to Darwin and you know, the other tropical areas around Australia, as they would do to the hot areas and other places. Those that can't cope with it pack up and go home back to a cooler place. And we find a lot of, you know, if people are sent to work, if their families can't cope, they move back. What's really becoming alarming is that a lot of these areas are going to become even more intensively hot, and that's going to probably make even a smaller proportion of the population be able to cope. And, of course, all these places involve, you know, people that work in construction, people that climb up your telephone poles to fix those when the power blackout, the people that change your car tyres, the district nurses who go out and visit people. And, of course, in the heat waves in Australia, you could imagine the district nurses are really not very inclined to call in sick saying, oh, no, look, it's too hot, because they know that if they don't go out and visit the people in their care, they're going to die. And so the people that sort of push themselves beyond their thermal tolerance tend to fall into a few categories. There are those with the awful employers that force them. Hopefully in you know, a civil society, we don't have ugly, horrible employers much anymore, but of course some will still exist. Or people that are in fear of losing their jobs. It's also people that feel responsible. You know, they're responsible like the essential services, the police, the ambulance, the district nurses, the SES who come and save you or fix your telephone poles, or the military, of course, have been another category. In fact, a lot of the early work on heat tolerance actually came out of the military, as they were finding that the soldiers were dying in training, and it was pretty difficult for the military to send letters home to their mothers saying, look, sorry, your son died. He didn't see combat. We just pushed him too hard. And so there is an upper thermal tolerance. We don't actually know what that is. There has been virtually no work done on this as far as the general working population around Australia, you know, in the world. And that's what my project's actually trying to do, and find out what strategies work, what don't work, because we're certainly going to have to change our way of thinking. Because the bottom line is that when you've got a hot place like Australia, and this is the same for all those Asian countries, the economy cannot tolerate us thinking, okay, well, it's summer, we have to down tools and industry just to shut up shop. Conversely, we can't keep pushing people until they die. And, of course, a lot of those jobs just can't be done in air-conditioned comfort. But, we really need to sort out how we're going to cope with this. And the bottom line is that if the planet keeps warming, it's going to be a real problem.
It's going to affect our whole economy.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. For the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Liz Hanna from Australian National University. She is a specialist in how the human body handles extreme heat. And as you point out, there have been studies done for the military and also for athletes, how they're going to cope, say, in the Summer Olympics. But it seems like we haven't done much about the miners, the farmers, or the people who keep our whole system going. What does need to be done?
I think we need a new mindset. There are certain tasks that we can leave till the cooler part of the day and do in, you know, the cooler times of the year. But there are certain tasks that really do need to be done. In some industries, that might mean having cool rooms where people can actually go out, do their job and come in and cool down. Because certainly, I mean, even in Australia, some jobs are done at night. As it is, a lot of the road making in summer is done at night. Picking the grapes is done at night, although I'm told that that's actually largely because it's better for the grapes rather than for the people. It's a sad reflection. I understand that in countries such as yours where you have blizzards and snow, that there's tolerance when there are blizzards and snow and people can't move. Even in places like Australia, there isn't. We don't have formalised tolerances for houses taking too long to be built or people not coming into work in those jobs that have some flexibility because of the heat. We're not taught in the health curricula about heat because it seemed to be such a rare thing and it just wasn't on the radar. And of course now it's something that we're just going to have to educate ourselves and actually permeate it through, you know, through society, making people being aware of looking out for each other, looking out for their children, looking out for their elderly, and being tolerant on each other in terms of the workplace and expectations.
Well, Dr. Hanna, I'm assuming some industries and companies will be too slow to make the necessary changes. And will we see more occupational injuries and death due to a hotter climate, I would expect? And if so, what would that look like?
Sadly, yes, that probably is true because it's, in an ideal world, all industries, all companies and everyone would behave perfectly. Although sadly, we realize this isn't always the case. There are some positive movements that we're seeing in Australia now, but of course, interestingly, they're the ones that are signing into being participants in my project. They're the ones that actually recognise that heat is an issue. Those that say, oh, no, not interested, they're the ones that we really do need to get to. But of course, you can't participate in people who won't engage with you. And you wonder what their work practices are.
What does it look like at the medical level when these things happen?
There's a few things. At the light level, dehydration is a really, really key part of it because of the extra strain it puts on the body. When people get to a certain level of dehydration, and it's really at the very early stages, your cognitive function starts to diminish. This becomes really problematic if people are in charge of heavy equipment or making decisions. And this is only when you're, you know, only a few percent, very small percent of dehydration. There's other risks such as even just sweaty hands and people's, you know, slipping and dropping things. And so the occupational health and safety is an issue in that respect. And that can come at even sort of the early stages. In the hot places such as one of our tropical towns, Darwin, 80% of the violence happens during certain months of the year, which is called the build-up, and that's when it gets really hot and the humidity starts to kick in. And this is the male-to-male violence and the domestic violence. That's huge. It's because it becomes very oppressive. So there's mental health issues as well in terms of, you know, violence and irritation, aggression. And physiologically, it's interesting the pathway that happens. It's, if you're fully acclimatized, obviously what our body tries to do is to kick in the thermoregulatory system, and that's when it's hot, it's largely through perspiration. So we start sweating a lot. Sweating adds to the dehydration. And the other thing is when it's hot, we try to shed heat by opening up all the skin blood vessels, which means that the volume of your blood vessels opens up a lot. So A, you're losing fluid by sweating. B, it's opening up the vessels, and if you increase the volume of the circulatory system, the pressure goes down, which means you really do need to drink to fill up that volume. If you're not drinking enough, that means that your heart is working really, really hard to keep perfusing that. And if you're working or exercising or doing things, it's also trying to send a lot of blood through your muscles. At the same time, it's trying to dissipate heat by sending a lot of blood to the skin. And so it's working, that's what it goes very, very hard, and it works very fast and very strong beats. And that's why the people that have compromised cardiac performance, they're the ones that are likely to suffer early. And of course, just in heat waves, even if people aren't actually working, it's one of the reasons why you find the elderly who are the first to succumb. But of course, that can happen to anyone who's pushing themselves too hard. And people tend not to recognise it. In a place like Australia, some of the responses we're getting from people we interview is that, look, it's just summer, get over it. You know, don't be wussy. You know, you can keep going, just, you know, soldier on. And I think this is where we need to change our mindset in the fact that recognise that heat can kill and is killing people. In fact, it's already killing more people than the road death. And heat has killed more people in Australia than any other natural hazard ever. And this is repeated annually. And this is even prior to the increased deaths that we're having with all these extra fires and, you know, these extreme heat waves. Because, I mean, we got up to, a city in Melbourne, you know, 4 million people. On the outskirts of Melbourne was just under 50 degrees. And that's 50. A city can't cope with temperatures like that. the train lines buckled, so we had to stop the trains and put people out on buses and walking in extreme heat. It's just not tenable.
Our guest has been Dr. Elizabeth Hanna, an expert in global heating and human health at the Australian National University. Thank you so much, Dr. Hanna.
Absolute pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Journalists love to worry what will happen if heat devastates food production in one of the three so-called breadbasket countries, the ones that feed millions around the world because they have enough to export. We know because it has already happened in spectacular fashion in Russia in 2010. In my archives, I have various quotes from top Russian politicians promising global warming would be good for the country. More heat would expand the growing area in Siberia, for example. Everyone wants shorter winters. Then reality called. The Russian heat wave was a multi-factor catastrophe. A study by a team of University of Oxford experts estimated at least 55,000 people died during it. Here again, we likely have a cause of natural variability. It might have been hot, but it was totally pumped up by climate change. That heat wave was poorly reported in the Western press. It was a new level of heat, and reports from the Russian government were sporadic. I followed a couple of dozen sources and pieced it together. Then I phoned Vladimir Chuparov of Greenpeace Russia. He was living through the heat wave in Moscow. Here are a couple of short clips from our radio interview.
This is a serious abnormality. The Russian Weather Service has never measured such temperatures in Moscow in July. According to our calculations, it hasn't even reached its peak yet.
The Arctic ice again retreated to near record low levels. In the United States, new heat records were set in many states. In fact, 17 different countries set all-time heat records this past summer, from Latin America through Africa and the Middle East to Russia itself. In Pakistan, floods beyond imagination created the world's largest humanitarian disaster. But the harbinger, the messenger from the future, took the Russian people into uncharted hell. Moscow, at the latitude of Alaska, boiled in the weather of Cairo, while grasping smoky air equivalent to two packs a day of cigarettes for every man, woman, and child. Russian leaders who bragged global warming would be good for that northern country got a taste of the coming century. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. The heat, drought, and fires in Russia during the summer of 2010 were truly shocking. To make sense of this, we're joined by Vladimir Chuparov. Vladimir, were you in Moscow during the heat wave, and can you describe your personal experience of these events?
This is Vladimir Chuparov. Yes, all this summer I spent in Moscow. And 2 weeks was most difficult, as it was a smog, around-the-clock smog in Moscow. Just to explain you, it was smelling with fire, so with temperature plus 40 degrees Celsius, which is absolutely untypical for Moscow, which is 20 degrees above the typical temperature this time. The visibility in the street, this distance of visibility was about 200 meters. People walking in the street with masks, not all of them, but a lot. And in a few hours of walking the street with masks, the mask is becoming brown. The air was full of carbon monoxide, which caused a lot of deaths, and the death rate in Moscow decreased twice. So it was quite horrible. So people waiting all the time. So it was impossible to open windows around the clock, especially in the night, as then the smoke get to the flat, to inside. So it was very extreme, especially for children and the people having disease, blood and lung disease. So all the people had shock, as it was quite untypical, and people were not ready for such extreme conditions, weather conditions. And psychologically, it was very frustrating, as people understood they can do nothing in this situation, because the power, the Ministry of Emergency Situation, who was in charge for firefight in this pit box near Moscow, they could do nothing. And it was a situation when the human being could not control the nature processes. which was very unusual and typical, and it showed that sometimes that the humankind, it coming to end, so it cannot control anything in this planet. So psychologically, it shaked Russian public, Russian society.
Well, thank you so much, Vladimir. And I want to say, reporting from Moscow, our guest has been Vladimir Chuprov. He's the head of the energy unit at Greenpeace Russia. Right, and Moscow is located at 56 degrees north. That's a similar latitude to the Alaskan Panhandle or Glasgow in Scotland. And so a warm, sunny day should be about 75 degrees there, not over 100 degrees or 38 Celsius as it was day after day. Whether or not the Russian firestorm was directly caused by climate change, it is a hard lesson on what we can expect from the future. Here are just a few of the issues stirred up by the heat, the smoke, and the drought, and the fires. Learn what you will from these 15 warnings.
Number 1.
Fatalities from heat and smog caused the death rate to double in Moscow. Large cities can be attacked by climate change to become deadly traps.
2.
An estimated 2,000 Russians drowned trying to escape the heat. Some died in drinking fountains. Some drank too much alcohol trying to cope with the heat and stress.
3.
The fires revealed the extreme and nearly uncontrollable dangers posed by climate change to nuclear facilities, both power reactors and military bases. Think upon that.
Number 4.
Many people tried to leave the big city, Moscow, but were prevented by smoke-closed roads and airports. Subways became dangerous. Traffic accidents and fatalities went way up. Essential goods, including food and medical supplies, couldn't get through. Transportation systems break down.
5.
The number of homeless people grew as villages were burned out.
6.
Peat fires went up to 12 feet underground and are expected to burn until winter.
7.
Crops die. 1/5 of the Russian grains were lost, exports banned, and international wheat prices rose. In the future, grain importers like the North African nations may starve. Let's take a few minutes from our countdown to listen to this press conference with Lester Brown. He's the founder of World Watch and founder of Earth Policy Institute. His latest book is Plan B 4.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization. I recorded his web conference for journalists in August. Lester Brown has been tracking the world's grain supplies for decades.
Another thing that I've learned, at least from this experience, is how lucky we have been that this heat wave was in Moscow and not in Chicago or Beijing. I say that because Russia produces at most 100 million tons of wheat. Even if it loses 40% of the harvest, which it's close to doing now, it would be a loss of 40 million tons in the world grain harvest. But if Chicago were to have a July with average temperatures 14 degrees above the norm, the U.S. could lose half of its grain harvest. The U.S. harvests about 400 million tons of grain a year. 300 million of that is corn. Most of it grown in the Midwest. Chicago is at the heart of the U.S. Corn Belt. 50% of 400 million tons would be 200 million tons. But even 150 or 100 million tons would be an enormous setback for a world where carryover stocks are right on the edge of what we consider to be secure. Or we could look at Beijing. Beijing is near the heart of the North China Plain, which produces half of China's wheat and a third of its corn. China, like the U.S., produces 400 million tons of grain per year. A heat wave in the North China Plain could easily cut that harvest by 100 million tons, maybe by 150 or more. What I draw from this is that we have to take global warming far more seriously than we are now doing as a society. If this teaches us anything, it is that we need to cut carbon emissions and cut them fast. We need to cut them fast before climate change spirals out of control. Because if we reach that point, then intense heat waves, such as the one that's taken over Moscow and indeed much of Western Russia over the last 7 weeks, could be occurring more frequently and in more dangerous places in terms of world food security. I've mentioned Chicago and Beijing. I could mention other places. But to anyone who's prepared to think about it, this heat wave centered around Moscow has to be a wake-up call for the world. And we need to do something about climate change and do it quickly.
That was Lester Brown, author of Plan B 4.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization. Now we continue with lessons for the future from the grim heat wave and firestorm in Russia during the summer of 2010.
Number 8.
Home gardens, community gardens, and survival gardens died. Beyond certain limits, plants cannot cope with a hotter climate and drought. Survivalists should begin testing their varieties and their strategies for cooling plants and watering them, or consider relocating to a microclimate regulated by the ocean or other large bodies of water.
Number 9.
Mobile conditioners sold out within 3 weeks, just as the heat set in. Many Moscow-based companies failed to foresee this heat, and they didn't want to fill their warehouses because of the crisis.
In a situation where no amount of money can buy you a gulp of fresh air, emergency centers are receiving thousands of calls from people suffering from heat stroke and sunburn.
People with lung diseases will find it hard, of course, so it'd be better to take them somewhere where there's no smoke. Another option would be to buy them a respiratory mask. They sell them in pharmacies.
Natalia Noikova, RT, Moscow.
Fans, air conditioners, and inflatable pools sold out very quickly. Money could not buy a cool place or fresh air. Air conditioners may be useless if the power goes out. Consider your tools.
10.
Some wealthy Russians were able to get out, including government officials. With the poor stuck and dying, class stress or even violence is possible during extreme climate events. Think New Orleans under Hurricane Katrina.
11.
The electric grid is strained and power lines burned down, including those coming from nuclear power stations. Brownouts and blackouts are likely in the future, even in countries like Great Britain or America.
Number 12.
People suffer extreme psychological stress. Will your baby, grandma, or asthmatic husband be okay? Are you afraid to go out for work or supplies? Will crime and violence flare in the day-after-day relentless heat? Do people come to fear the weather? What are the long-term mental health risks?
Of when the fire started, and it was literally just a wall of fire as tall as the trees. It was terrifying, and they said that it all happened in almost a matter of seconds. There was almost literally nothing people could do. The fire spread from the trees to the houses, burning them down in seconds. People losing everything that they've been accumulating for their entire lives. Now they don't know what to do, how to start over again. And this, of course, is just one of the villages in Russia where such a terrible thing has happened all across the country, with the fires ravaging central Russia for over a month. Thousands of people have been left homeless.
13.
Even more carbon was released into the atmosphere. Global warming will feed more global warming. The Russian fires released millions of tons of carbon from the forests into the sky. The black particles swirled up into the international Arctic, darkening snow, hastening more melting. Brown clouds traveled as far as Beijing.
14.
The economic costs continue to mount for Russia. Forest jobs lost, workers don't show up, expensive firefighting and restoration costs, roads wiped out, crops wiped out, including orchards, farm equipment, and buildings. In Russia, the loss is estimated at least 1% of the GDP.
And number 15.
Public anger mounts, and big government often fails to handle anything with competence. Regime change, as we may yet see in Pakistan after the floods, is always possible after major climate hits. The long-term impact on public confidence is unknown. Governments may swing to authoritarian forms or break down into smaller states or even anarchy. The only way to control our path toward the future, to limit the horror of these trends, is to control our carbon emissions and other greenhouse gases. The alternative, as Climate Progress blogger Joe Rome says, is hell and high water. After studying this 2010 heat disaster intensively, I published 15 short things to learn from it. These are the takeaways. And every one of them applies to extreme heat and wildfires bubbling up all over the world during the last year and right now in many parts of the world, including, of course, California. Well, it's time to say goodbye to somebody. There is a saying in science that no one is convinced of a new paradigm.
As the famous German physicist Max Planck said, a new scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and making them see the light, but rather because its opponents eventually die and a new generation grows up that is familiar with it. So it is with climate change. Here is American Senator and Chief Climate Denier James Inhofe back in 2010.
I don't think that anyone disagrees with the fact that we actually are in the middle of a cold period that started about 9 years ago.
James Inhofe died July 9, 2024, during extreme heat across the American West, including his home state of Oklahoma. His claim that Earth was cooling has been proven wrong, dead wrong. The original climate deniers and fossil fuel profiteers will all die away, leaving generations to suffer in heat, storms, fires, and a dying natural world. Every child will grow up in a destabilized climate. They will know. You can get an electronic book with my best of Radio EcoShock interviews all transcribed on heat just by sending me an email. I will send back a PDF format ebook for free. I don't keep a mailing list of listener names. There are no catches or sales angles. Use the subject line free book, and I will send you Surviving the New Age of Extreme Heat. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. Feel free to email me anytime with your experiences, what's going on in your world, and ideas for the show. I always like to hear from listeners, podcast subscribers, and from blog readers. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening during these hot times and caring about our world.